Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening to the show, friends. Always a pleasure to have you here this week, each and every week. Well, maybe not next week. Quick programming note for you. We're going to be taking the week off from doing the show for the 4th of July holiday. We'll be back with a new show the week after. Right now, the plan as it stands is an interesting discussion about one of my favorite wine regions on the planet, California's Livermore Valley. You may not know a lot about it or anything about it, but it's a wine region you really should know about, and it's a place that's near and dear to my heart, and we'll get into that when we actually bring you the show. So be on the lookout for that. I'll have some more information coming out on that in the very near future. Good show here this week, friends. We're talking about honeybee conservation, obviously a very critical issue to all of us on the planet. Two guests are joining us to address honeybee conservation. One is Ted Dinard. Ted is the founder and owner of the Savannah Bee Company, a honey producer out of Savannah, Georgia. And also Mati Antila, who is the founder and owner of Dixie Southern Vodka. They're very active in honeybee conservation. Programming note here on this one, too, friends. Dixie Southern Vodka is the official vodka of NASCAR. Now, when we tape this interview, the story, NASCAR had banned the Confederate flag from its events, from its races, and rightfully so. But the story regarding the noose found in Bubba Wallace's garage had not yet broken. So we don't discuss that. Certainly, had that news been out, it would have been asked about. We would have touched on it, but it was not out. If you are listening on the radio, I do encourage you to go to NOLADrinks.com in a day or two and get the podcast. We have our podcast-only segment, Another Shot with NOLA Drinks. On this show, during that segment, I asked Mati to address not only the name Dixie Southern Vodka, get his view on that, as well as NASCAR and some of the steps that NASCAR is attempting to take to be more inclusive. Now, after the news story broke, I reached out to them to see if they wanted to make a statement furthering the conversation, and they did, so I will read that to you now. Quote, successful brands and organizations can have a significant role bringing about change, highlighting the best of today and making a real difference. Vodka is not going to bring about world peace, but it sure can bring people together. An overdue conversation about equality and justice is blooming across all segments of the population. As Dixie Southern Vodka, we are focused on how we can bring people together, not exclude or marginalize. Specific to NASCAR, we had immediately affirmed our support of their decision to ban the Confederate flag from races, and as an official partner of NASCAR, we are proud to stand alongside them in supporting the evolution of the sport, including introducing it to new fans throughout our country and the world. We were also relieved by the conclusion of the FBI investigation and moved by the display of unity shown by the drivers. I look forward to many more years of highlighting the diverse and authentic flavors, people, and traditions that make the South an amazing place to call home. End quote. Did want to share that with you. I'll mention a little bit more about this in our parting shot at the end of the podcast only segment when we close out the show. NASCAR's got a lot of work to do, right? Got to do the work. Can't just be performative. It'll be interesting to see, especially when we look at who their demographic is, or much, I should say, of their demographic is, where that's all going to land. But I do appreciate them sharing this statement with me. And again, I do encourage you to get the podcast because we do talk further about NASCAR and, again, the name Dixie Southern Vodka. But this show is about honeybee conservation, friends. That's what we're talking about here, a very important issue to all of us. And I find it's a very fascinating conversation. I hope you find it that way as well. Take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends, and we're going to be back talking about honeybees. Come on back.
Queen bee, queen bee. Queen bee, please come back to me. Queen bee, queen bee, queen bee. Yes, queen bee. Queen bee, please come back to me. Cause you got the best old stinger.
All right, everybody, welcome back. back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it, as always. A little bit of a technological experiment here is that we are utilizing Zoom for the first time to bring in multiple guests on the NOLA Drinks Show. Fingers crossed that it goes well, everybody out there for us. God knows I need it. But we are here talking about a couple great guests that are joining the show. Madi Antala, who is the founder and owner of Dixie Vodka. Madi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And Ted Dennard, who is the founder and owner. We have two founder and owners. Founder and owner of the Savannah Bee Company here joining us. How are you, Ted?
I'm very good. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks, you guys. I appreciate it. Friends out there, as you know, we're going to talk a little bit about vodka and stuff like that, but we're also going to talk about bee conservation, which is a very important topic. If you listen to the show for a long time, you know we've touched on that issue as it relates to Mezcal. Guys, you and I were talking about that before we got on the air about Mezcal in general, and we know that the bee connection there is really important. But let me start with you, Madi. Let's talk a little bit about Dixie Vodka, a really interesting company there in South Carolina. Maybe just give us the quick 411 on the company and how you got involved making vodka, man.
Yeah, so I started Dixie in 2014. I've been in the spirit space since, I guess, about 2005, 2006, so about 15 years, and have been involved in creating brands, buying brands, resurrecting brands. Coming out of the downturn, kind of 08 through 10, really saw a shift in the vodka space from super premium imports to domestic premiums, premium vodkas, most notably obviously Tito's, and was really looking at what, craft distillers around the Southeast were doing and really realized that while everyone was focused on, at that point, a lot of moonshine, and then just whiskey in general. And, you know, vodka is a huge category. Obviously it's the third of the total market in spirits in the U.S. And really people were kind of ignoring it. And I felt that there was an opportunity to create a vodka that, whether you were in Miami, Richmond, or New Orleans, or anywhere in between, you could really call your own. So that was really the guiding kind of force behind Dixie, was to try and create a brand that could really represent the best of the South, using Southern ingredients, working with Southern partners, highlighting all the great things that were happening from a food scene, culinary, craftsmanship, and do so in a way that really represented the region, as opposed to being kind of just solely about coming from, you know, a single place. And so we launched it in 2014. Now we are pretty much national. We've been slowed down a little bit in the expansion because of COVID. But we're the official vodka of NASCAR. We just had our NASCAR Cup Series race, the Dixie Vodka 400, this past Sunday in Homestead, Miami. So it's been very exciting. As far as we can tell, we are the largest premium vodka produced in the Southeast. So, people really embrace the brand. And through the process, we've just been able to work with amazing partners, and really hopefully highlighting the best of the South today in 2020.
Very cool. And let me ask you this question too, Madi, and then I'm going to get to you, Ted, about Savannah Bee Company. But one of the parts that seems to be integral to Dixie Vodka and you, Madi, is the idea of giving back to the planet, environmental causes, which is obviously what we're going to talk about bee conservation here in a bit. But you guys have been involved in that since you started, right, as far as supporting environmental issues?
Correct. Yeah, we've been a part of 1% for the planet since really the beginning. Just in general, I'm a big fan of the outdoors, it's always been a big part of my life growing up to my adult life, and so that's always been just personally something that I've really cared about, and so I wanted to incorporate that into what we were doing as a company generally. But then with Dixie, it's been a great opportunity to, through our participation in 1%, to one, bring some great groups, like, as we'll talk about the Bee Cause here in a little bit, we help them bring them into the network for 1% for a planet. It's allowed us to work on a lot of really different, interesting things that have impacted the, environment in the Southeast. But now as we get bigger, we're working on stuff that's not just confined to the region. So it's been pretty exciting.
Very cool. Ted, now you started the Savannah Bee Company, and so why don't you tell us about that, but then we're going to get to the bee cause, so I'll kind of have you segue into that after you tell us about Savannah Bee Company, man.
Sure. The Savannah Bee Company is something that kind of blossomed out of a kind of a lifelong love for bees. I've been a beekeeper over 40 years, taught beekeeping in the Peace Corps in Jamaica for 2 years. Oh, wow. Have just loved it. And started selling some honey about 20 years ago, and this company kept just growing. And then I officially launched it in 2002. We've been wholesaling. We opened up retail stores of our own in 2008. We have 14 of those spread around, and it's just been a wild ride, really. So we've grown a lot for a small honey company. We're still not a big company, but we sell kind of all over the country, and have a sort of a different business model, which is kind of based on a beehive. So we sort of take their cue in the way that everything they touch is benefited. So we see it. I was a religion major, right? So
okay.
It's just philosophy, right? But so I want my products to benefit the end user, right? So they're going to be benefited, just like the way a bee does to flowers. And then, you know, from there it feeds the planet. But we're supporting beekeepers who are supporting the bees and the bees. And if you get me started, and I won't do it here, I can enlighten you on how they're keeping the world going around, basically.
Oh, I think we do definitely want to talk about that, Ted, but go on. What were you going to say? Sorry.
Okay. No, and so that's sort of our business model. So we want to keep growing the business so that we can keep making a bigger impact. We want to leave a big positive footprint behind us. So,
did you grow?
That's what we do.
Great. Okay. Did you grow up around beekeeping, or what made you
gravitate
towards it?
There was an elderly gentleman, Roy Hightower, down in Brunswick, Georgia, put his beehives on my dad's land. We had 100 acres of land, and it was all forested. And he put his hives there, and I was 14 years old, and just 13 or 14, and just started working with him on the weekends. And then I kind of inherited his bees after he died. And anyway, it's just followed me kind of through life. It really, when I look backwards, it looks like destiny for sure. But I didn't realize it back then, that's for sure.
Gotcha.
I wanted to be a professor. And now I kind of just preach the gospel of the honeybee.
There you go. That's a good gospel to preach, man.
We do a lot of education, awareness. We started that not-for-profit, the Bee Cause, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, well, let's go there now. So tell us a little bit. So you did you start the Savannah Bee Company before the nonprofit, or did the nonprofit come first?
So the Savannah Bee Company started first, and then 10 years into it, I hired a CEO to run the company, and I kind of fired myself as the boss because I'm definitely not that great at it. And I had some time, and I started doing this. I put a beehive inside of a school, a glass educational observation beehive. I started in Charleston, and then another school wanted one, and another. And we started after like the second one, we were talking as we're installing it. We're drilling holes through school buildings and doing some stuff we've learned better now. But we're like, God, these people are embracing it so much. If we could put a beehive in 1,000 schools, we could raise a whole generation that understand, love, and they will protect the honeybee. So that was the founding of it. And we started it, and quickly, probably 2012, 2013, we had a 501c3, and it's just been growing ever since. And so partners like Mati have been really great in helping us to get where we need to get. And we have 600 and something schools now that we've installed hives in, and we're now creating these digital beehives that we can put everywhere. So it's exciting.
That's really cool. So it's a very hands-on, and it's directly intersecting by supporting beekeepers. That's the focus.
Well, it does support beekeepers, but the main thing is it's going inside classrooms primarily, right? So you've got these kids in the, you know, let's say the third grade of this elementary school, and they all get to see bees, and the bees are coming and going through a hole in the wall, and this is 8 frames of bees. They watch them building the honeycomb, bringing in the pollen, doing the waggle dance, like communicating to each other. The queen's laying. They see honey being filled up and capped off. And I mean, they're just, and then, you know, they're connecting it, the science of it with the pollination and the plant world. So it's a real educational, it's a teaching tool for the teachers. And they say, like, when kids are engaged in something like real life like that, that I think the retention is like about six times greater, whatever they're teaching. So teachers love it. The kids love it. And they rope their parents into it. It's like there's a big ripple that goes outward from that just one installation in the school.
Absolutely. That's very cool. Machi, let me ask you this. So I'm sipping on the Dixie honey vodka right now, which seems the wildflower honey vodka, which seems to be very appropriate for our conversation. How did you guys connect to collaborate on this? How do y'all know each other?
Yeah. So it really came out of, we have our core Southern vodka, which is, you know, six times distilled from corn, and, you know, it's a fantastic product, and it's our lead horse. But, you know, there's only so many, you know, it's basically a single ingredient that goes into that. Right. So, and it's not necessarily corn. I like the look of cornfields. There's not a ton of romance in cornfields. Right. So the idea behind the flavors that we've released has really been, how do we take kind of iconic ingredients in the South and incorporate them into kind of the brand story, and whether they're limited releases or kind of a full, you know, fully part of our lineup every day. You know, we really wanted to not only take things that were, you know, authentic and iconic to the South, but also really directly tied to single farms and ingredient partners. So we can really tell their story at the same time as we were telling ours. And, you know, we started out and we had our mint vodka and a black pepper, and the mint it comes from Kentucky. And so it got a great story behind it. And the black pepper, we source most of the peppers, you know, in the Charleston area. And I was thinking about, you know, what the next thing we were going to do from a flavor standpoint. And I wanted to do something that also had, even though we were part of 1% for the planet, I wanted to do something that with a single product that we could have more of a direct impact and direct story around, you know, the positive benefit of it. So, you know, that was kind of going through my head. And I was walking down King Street in Charleston one day, and I went into the Savannah Bee Company store there, and I did a honey tasting. And, you know, at that moment, it just kind of occurred to me, I said, God, this would be a really great collaboration with our vodka. I love the idea that Savannah Bee Company was just down the road in Savannah. So it was a very kind of company to company, you know, collaboration. I thought, you know, honey and vodka is a great combination. And so I reached out to Ted. It might have even just been, you know, info@SavannahBeeCompany, or maybe it was LinkedIn. I can't remember how it all started, but it was basically just a cold call and said, hey, this is who we are. I love what you guys do. You know, I think we could probably create a pretty delicious product together. And that's how it started. And then as I got to know Ted and understand more about Savannah Bee Company and get introduced to the Bee Cause, it really started coming together in a very kind of natural and fluid way. And, you know, luckily, I mean, when we tried different types of honey and we ended up settling on the wildflower honey, but, you know, we quickly found out that it was going to create a very delicious product, which, you know, is at the end of the day, we want people to enjoy what they're drinking. So that was key. But then it just got this amazing story to tell around it as well. And, you know, so it was kind of a best of all worlds situation.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, let's do this, you guys. Let's take a little bit of a break here on the show, and then we're going to come back and chat a little bit further. Talk a little bit more about honeybees, why we all need to care about honeybees. And we all really do need to care about honeybees, believe me. You guys stick around for a little bit longer?
Perfect.
All right. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on, man. We'll be right back. everybody. Welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. We are chatting with Mati Antila, who is the founder and owner of Dixie Vodka, and Ted Dinard, who is the founder and owner of Savannah Bee Company, and also started the Bee Cause, a nonprofit that supports honeybee conservation. And I do want to talk about this, Ted, because I think maybe for those of us who don't remember our elementary school or middle school science lessons, let's go all the way back to that level of, you know, why do honeybees matter, and why do we, everybody on the planet, why do we need to care about them?
Well, I'll try and keep it as brief as I can, just because it's such a deep topic.
Sure.
But you can go back, whatever, 100, 150 million years ago, where bees branched off from wasps, and then they started co-evolving with the plant world. So literally for eons longer than we have been here, there's been this co-evolution with the bees pollinating, cross-pollinating the plants, giving them strength, and through the genetic diversity that causes that. So they're able to outcompete. So the world that we landed in is a direct result of this relationship between the bees and the plant world. And it's a beautiful dance, right? They're both benefited at the same time. It's a symbiotic relationship, something we should all strive toward in life. And one of the byproducts of that is food, nuts, seeds, fruits. And if you like to eat, you better love your bees, right? If you don't love your bees for loving bees, then just love them for your own personal safety, because we got to have them, and because we got to eat. They're responsible, directly responsible for one third of every bite of food that we eat.
And tell us a little bit more about how does that work? Why is that the case? Beyond, you know, people know about pollination, but.
Right. Well, so let's take an apple orchard. If you put beehives on the apple orchard, if you don't put bees there, you're still going to get some pollination and you'll get some apples. But if you put bees there, you're going to have more apples, bigger apples. And so they're going to increase the production by at least a third. Okay, that's apples. If you want to go to almonds, they have to have bees. You don't get crop insurance unless you have two beehives per acre.
Wow.
So for almonds, and you don't get an almond unless you have bees. You got to have it. Otherwise, no almond. So every single beehive in the nation goes to California in like February to pollinate almonds. I mean, almost literally every beehive, because they started growing so many almonds. So, wow. And then it's just, the range goes. If you like pickles, then you got to have them. That whole cucurbit family, all of the squashes and melons and cucumbers, all that, got to have bees. It's incredible. And even beef, right? So what we feed beef is a lot of alfalfa. You like a hamburger? Well, you better love your bees, because the alfalfa needs the bees. So it goes way beyond, I mean, mustard. I mean, things that you don't think of, tomatoes. You got to have bees. Yes.
Ted, let me ask you this, because when you were talking about the almond growing in California, so the beehives are actually taken. So there's like a mobile component to the business where they're brought out there to do this and then brought back to where they came from?
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, there's such a huge population of people on the planet, right? That's kind of the way we have to grow food now. So they put 450 up to 500 beehives on a tractor trailer. They put a net on it and they ship it to California. They unload them, put them in staging yards, and then disseminate them throughout all the orchards there. So it's a big operation. And honestly, at first, a lot of the beekeepers I worked with didn't do it because they were worried about their bees. But then they saw, A, how much money the beekeepers were making, and B, that the bees were coming back in time to and in good shape to make honey. So it was like a win-win, really, for the beekeeping industry and the beekeepers. As you know,
wow. So they'll go out there and do their thing to pollinate, and then right. They come back to roost where they're supposed to. Then they're brought back home to actually produce honey.
Right. So what? February, you basically, it's winter, right, everywhere, especially the guys up north. But yeah, they're making honey. Some of the guys lose some of the orange blossom production in Florida if they do the almonds. But other than that, all the honeys are kind of after that, kind of March, April, May.
Interesting.
And the bees are back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool. Wow. I had no idea. Machi, tell me, when you started this collaboration with Ted to do the wildflower honey vodka, did you already have a general interest in bees, or did this kind of broaden because of this relationship and the product?
Yeah, so I had some interest in bees, and very, I would say an amateurish interest, but I had actually had an experience up in the mountains of North Carolina my wife and I did a day as a beekeeper kind of excursion. And so, it started in the morning and through the afternoon, it seemed kind of like a fun thing to do. It was a beautiful setting near near Highlands, North Carolina. And we got to, put on the suit and interact with the bees. And, we had been up in the mountains for a couple of weeks. And so we were kind of looking for things to do, and it just kind of popped on the radar. And I'd always been interested in, just kind of loosely in bees and knew a bit about, some of the issues, out there. And so I was excited to learn more. And that was actually right before I had then kind of stumbled into the Savannah Bee Company store in Charleston. So, bees were definitely on my mind. And having had that experience firsthand definitely helped me kind of understand, some of the complexities around, beekeeping and honey production, which I think, was definitely helpful when starting to work with Ted and his team on the collaboration. And then as soon as I met Ted in person, he had me, in a hive.
In short order.
In short order without the full suit. So it was a different experience, but it was, it was great. And, and that really, it just got me deeper into it to the point now where, it really is the because is the largest, beneficiary of our 1% commitment as a company. And that's really grown over these last couple of years as we've gotten more involved and we've branched out and we've done more projects and, we've got a great project in Puerto Rico going. And, so it's been fun. And through the process, I've definitely learned more. And, it's easy to kind of get excited about the bees as you lean in more.
Right. Right on. Let me ask you, we got about a minute and a half or so before we take another break. When we say in this case, so wildflower honey, so it's the different, Ted, educate us on this in about a minute and a half. What does that mean? What kind of honey is this that I'm tasting in the vodka?
So, there's some parts of the world, they call it Miliflora, which just means like thousand flower honey. It basically means whatever honey. We don't know what honey it is. Okay. It's what for flowers. I do know what honey is in there, and there's a lot of holly in the honey that my tea gets, and mostly it is a holly, then you can get some other stuff in there. There's a little blend of things.
So generally when somebody says wildflower, then that means it's kind of like a blender, like a field blended, we'd say, in wine. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. This is a whole bunch. It could be, it could be 10 different things all together that you could wait and extract all of your honey at the end of the summer and just it'd be wildflower because it's everything that they've collected. Or, in the case that we do, it's kind of like we get that May, kind of the month of May honey, and we extract that. And it's primarily this holly bush. But it could have some palm in it. It could have some palmetto, small little palms in it. So it's a little bit of a mix.
Okay, gotcha. Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's go ahead and take a break right now, and then we're going to come back. We'll talk a little bit more about the Puerto Rico project that Mati mentioned, and want to ask Ted a little bit about some of the threats to honeybees, and we're going to let you know a little bit about what you can do to support some of the causes out there that we're talking about here today. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Dees here with WGSO 990 AM New Orleans and podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. Happy to have you here. We are chatting with Mati of Dixie Vodka and Ted of Savannah Bee Company. We're talking about honeybee conservation, you guys. And Mati, you mentioned before we went to the break about a really cool project going on in Puerto Rico. Can you tell us about that in a couple minutes or so?
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, we've been working with the Bee Cause for the last couple of years, and it's mostly been kind of just, it's beehives in the South, a little bit for venturing kind of out west. And, you know, as a brand, Dixie Vodka, as we expand out of our home region of the Southeast, I really wanted to find projects that we could work with the Bee Cause project on outside of our home region as well. And so we really would, in terms of talking where there are some opportunities, Puerto Rico came up, and I got really excited about it. It's a neat project that was started by out of a school called St. John's in San Juan. A very impressive girl named Issa had started this group called Be a Bee. And, you know, it really began with reaching out to Ted and Savannah Bee Company and the Bee Cause about getting an observation hive into the school. And then it's kind of evolved from there. And she's a very energetic and very impressive teenager. What ultimately ended up happening is they started a project to create a bee sanctuary about an hour outside of San Juan. There's beekeeper there, and there's, a number of hives, I think maybe 15 hives there. And they go out to the sanctuary from the school at least once a week, and work with the bees. And then they also then go around to other schools, and educate, other students and peers about the importance of bees. And what they really wanted to create was in this bee sanctuary, somewhere where they could bring kids and just generally people to really experience it firsthand, and to see it and feel it and smell it. Knowing from my personal experience, there's nothing like kind of being near and in a hive, right, to really allow you to understand and really get excited about what it's all about. And so we were excited to jump on board and help fund the sanctuary. We were down there in, I guess, February, for planning meetings, spent time at the school, with the students, and then out at the sanctuary and with the beekeeper and, with the organization that manages, it's basically a land conservancy, that is very big in Puerto Rico and has been buying land over the years. In the process of creating this great project that, originally was supposed to kind of the ribbon cutting was supposed to be this spring. But because of COVID, everything's been obviously delayed. But hopefully, it'll be ready to open to the public, sometime this summer. And Puerto Rico is a unique spot because it's obviously been decimated by hurricanes and there's been a lot of natural disasters there. But they also have a very unique strain of bee. It's an Africanized bee that is, and I'm not the expert on this, but is resistant to mites, which is a problem in the U.S. with a lot of our bees, where they'll be the mites will infiltrate the hive and kill the hive. Whereas in Puerto Rico, they effectively fight back and then they can kill the mites. So protecting them and ultimately allowing for the bee population in Puerto Rico, one, not only to be healthy in Puerto Rico, but potentially even exportable, is something that could potentially be very important for mainland United States. And so all those things kind of interweave in this project. And it's a really neat thing to be part of, in a beautiful country with wonderful people, or a beautiful state with wonderful people. But it's been interesting for sure.
Ted, do me a favor. Thank you, Mati.
Sure.
Because we were talking and we got about 5 minutes left before we got to cut out the radio portion of the show. We want to talk a little bit about threats to honeybees. We'll have to do kind of a short version. We'll get more into it in the podcast thing.
Absolutely.
But one of the things that Mati just mentioned were mites, and that's a significant threat.
Yeah. So, yeah, quickly, the mites are the – if there's a pyramid of problems that affect bees, and there are, there is – the very base of that is the mites. Without mites, a lot of these other stresses and issues the bees could probably deal with. This small mite, the primary one is Varroa destructor, but it's this Varroa mite. It's like a tick. If the mite, if you were the size let's say, if a bee was the size of you, that mite on it would be the size of a cat. So it's like a cat attaching to you and sucking your fluid out, right? So, I mean, it's a monster. So it does it at the larval stage, on the adults, and then worse than that, it also transmits all these viruses. So the viruses keep morphing and changing. I mean, it is a nasty thing.
So that's the threat from mites is it's a virus vector. Is that kind of what the
main virus thing? Vector primarily? That's more the problem than just the mite on the bee.
Okay,
is that virus? So, and that virus could be dormant, right? But then when the bees get stressed by, let's say, a neonicotinoid, some of these systemic chemicals that they put in plants, or some kind of spray, a toxic, you know, whatever's out there in the environment that we've put out there, it's a sublethal dose. It won't kill the bee, but it stresses the bee, and then the bee takes that back to the hive. The hive is then under stress, and then, you know, just like you, when you get stressed, your immune system gets compromised, and that virus that's been dormant expresses itself, and then your whole hive just wipes out. So they are the worst. There are plenty of other things. I mean, there's habitat loss, there's pollution, there's
chemicals that you mentioned in general, right?
Yeah, pesticides, insecticides. So I think, you know, what can you do to help bees? Because I always like to be on the positive, like what's constructive, right? So you can plant lots of flowers. You can kind of grow, don't mow, and just have a lot of wildflowers growing, many of which you might call weeds. But if there's a successive bloom of flowers, right? Not just one species that just blooms and 2 weeks later it's gone. They need something all along. And it's just like you need different vegetables to get different nutrients. They need different flowers to get different nutrients. The pollen that they get from these flowers is their protein, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, trace elements, everything. So it's really important. And bees only eat pollen and honey. They make the honey out of the nectar. The pollen they store in the combs too, but it's different. It's like a packed hard pollen. Mm-hmm. But that's what they eat. So planting, the other thing is to read the label. If you go organic, great. I know that's a hassle, and sometimes you got to use something, and just read the label and apply it. Bees are flying from dawn to dusk. So if you could do it right at dusk and apply whatever you need to do, make sure that it goes into the soil, like wash it in or whatever. Just read the instructions. And then seven dust, I don't want to just call them out, but it mimics pollen. Bees are hairy. That's what makes them great pollinators. But that seven dust sticks to them. That powdered seven dust is really deadly to bees. Okay. They take it back to the hive, spread it everywhere. So beware of that.
Beware of that. Okay. Well, do me a favor, you guys. I got about a minute and a half here before we're going to close out the radio portion of the show. Where do we find Ted Savannah Bee Company online, listing of all your stores and all that good stuff?
Hey, we are simple. We are at savannahbee.com. You can find us and order and do all that stuff. We love that. Love your support. If you can't stop by one of our stores, you can always go there. We're in Sedona and Boulder and everything. The Bee Calls Project is the Bee Calls, and that's beecalls.org.
And they're taking and there's a donate button right on top, which is another great way to help, right?
Exactly.
Mati, tell people where they can find Dixie Vodka online, man, and find out where they can find your product.
Yeah, so again, simple, dixievodka.com. And you can go on there, learn about the brand. There's links to being able to buy online, depending on what state you're in. A lot of states don't allow delivery of alcohol.
Sure.
More and more are, so that's always helpful. And then, our distribution, especially in the South, is very extensive, and it's getting bigger and bigger across the country. So, hopefully if you will go into your local, liquor store, they've got Dixie Vodka there. And if they don't, then ask them to get it.
Ask them to get it. DixieVodka.com. You guys are sticking around for another Shot with Nola Drinks, our podcast only segment. Sure. If you are listening on the radio, friends, go get the podcast, NolaDrinks.com. Remember now, more than ever, be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all.
inside. What are you doing in a place like this? I said I call your name, but no one came. Now I see you become just like the company you keep. Then he said, I'll be saints and I'll be sinners. We'll try.
All right, everybody, up another shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for sticking around. We are going to bounce right back over to our featured interview and continue our conversation with Mati and Ted. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks for sticking around, friends. Happy to have you here. As you know, we are chatting with Mati of Dixie Vodka and Ted of Savannah Bee Company. Ted, I want to ask you this question really quick because we were talking right when we closed the radio portion of the show about threats to honeybees. And I think people in recent weeks have seen a lot about the murder hornet. And that seems to be a bit of a pest from Asia that's, I think, made its way into the state of Washington, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, it is. Well, I think two things. One is with beekeeping, maybe honey industry in general, I mean, there's always a kick in the nuts, right? right. Like always, you turn around, you're just recovering, and then here comes another. The murder hornet, that thing arrives in Washington State. And if you recall, so did COVID. And remember that, we're going to try and contain it. Maybe we can just keep it here, limit the case. You know, it's the same thing. We can keep the hornets here. Maybe they won't travel. Like, it's really quite a parallel, I'll have to say.
Thanks, Washington.
Okay. But that having been said, I don't see this going across the country like COVID. I'm no expert, but I've, done a little bit of research. There's two things. One, they can decimate your hives. There's no question about it. They're bad. But so are so many other things. It is so hard to be a beekeeper. There's yellow jackets that'll decimate hives. We have a helicopter that sprays for mosquitoes here in Savannah and puts like a carcinogen in the air over all of us, right? It's nasty. Like, what are you doing? You'll be walking outside and they just crop dust you. But they're hitting the bees too, and they're indiscriminately killing all insects, so your hives, and we have these hives in schools, and there's a million issues. There always seems to be a new one. Beekeepers though are resilient, and they will keep bees alive. And even in the case of this murder hornet, if indeed it does spread, and I think it's doubtful because of climate and stuff, it'll go too far. We'll keep them going, right? So it's not the doom and gloom into the world or anything like that. That more than anything is it's kind of just media. I mean, it's real, but we're going to be okay.
Yeah, well, was that idiot, right, that was on YouTube that got himself stung just to show how cool he was?
I heard about that.
Yeah, I didn't watch it because I don't watch stuff like that. But apparently some YouTube guy got himself stung just to show how cool he was. And great.
I mean, that would hurt. Bees are one thing. Honeybees are sweet, I think. But you get stung every once in a while.
Yeah, sure. Well, Mati, let me ask you this. So, I have a peach vodka now in my glass. And so we're talking a little bit about some of the different the vodkas that you do. And one of the conversations that I wanted to have with you about vodka, kind of just in general, I sometimes get in arguments with some of my bartender friends and things like that, because some people fall very firmly, I think there's two parts to this, fall very firmly on the idea that vodka is supposed to be colorless, odorless, and tasteless. And then there's also maybe kind of adding that layer of some of the really the stigma that comes with flavored vodka, because like a lot of the stuff that came out 15, 20 years ago was awful, artificial, really terrible stuff. To the first part, what I always tell my friends who push back on vodka not being colorless, odorless, or tasteless, maybe having a different mash bill, doing something a little different. We've already got
Tito's and Smirnoff and Grey Goose and all these things on the market, that how many more do you need that are colorless, odorless, and tasteless, right? I'm kind of more interested personally in things that show some character that are out there, which I think some of your stuff has. But I think also when we kind of unpack what flavored vodka really is, when you do it well versus what has been done in the past, which has not been done well.
Yeah, for sure. I think the, I find, you know, if I'm tasting different, just plain vodkas from different mash bills, I generally can taste, you know, differences. And, you know, with a corn vodka like ours, and which is, you know, like Tito's, and it's really becoming, I think, American vodka as a category in general is generally, from a mash bill standpoint, is very corn focused, mm-hmm. and which provides a little bit of a sweeter taste profile, a little softer. And, you know, so, but for us, you know, and while we sell a lot of our core Southern vodka, it's their biggest seller by far, because that's what people want it. You know, they love just plain vodka. But, you know, the flavors give us a great opportunity to really highlight what makes our region unique, right, in terms of the fruits and the different flavors. And, you know, that's been an important part of it. And I think, you know, the stigma against flavored vodkas in the past has really been around, you know, there's more like confectionery type flavors, artificial. A lot of the big companies use flavor extensions as a way to continue growth of the brand. You know, if they stopped kind of issuing, you know, putting something new out, then, you know, they're just, you know, they would see the sales decline. So it was a very artificial kind of sales tool as well as very artificial flavors. And so, you know, at a certain point, you know, they're just, you know, I don't know how many Smirnoff flavors there were, probably 40 or 50, who knows. It just got too much. And, you know, but at the end of the day, people still like, I mean, there's a market for flavored vodka. And I think that the key, especially now, is really about having authentic flavors, natural flavors, and flavors that make sense for the brand's DNA. And that's what our real focus is it's, What are the flavors that we can work with that really link very closely to who we are as a brand, and, you know, a real pride in kind of the region that we come from. And so the peach is a great example. We work directly with Lane Southern Orchards in Macon, Georgia. They've been growing peaches for over 100 years. Fantastic company. And we get all of our peaches directly from Lane. And bring them to Charleston and to make our peach vodka. And, you know, it's a very close relationship with them. We're using the actual peaches, and, you know, and in that process and telling, you know, and marketing our peach vodka, just like we do with the wildflower honey, is we have this great opportunity to tell Lane's story as well. And it's also, it's just great. I mean, just like being at a beehive, and, you know, it's a very visual experience. I mean, the same thing as being in a, you know, a peach orchard, mm-hmm. right? It's a beautiful location to, you know, have content creation and talk about the actual ingredients that are going into the bottle. And, you know, we work really hard to make sure that those flavors really come through, in the drinking experience. And it's, you know, and it's a lot of experimentation around how much do you need to put in there. So it, especially because vodka is being mixed, right? So you need the flavors to really be able to punch through when you're mixing it. But we're proud of, you know, all the flavors that we've put out, and particularly because there is for everyone, there is a real, whether it's a farm or a producer or a partner, like in Ted's case, you know, that where this ingredient is coming from. And I think that's really important today, especially because people are really there. They want to know where all the ingredients, you know, come from, where the products that they are consuming and embracing and hopefully evangelizing, you know, they want to know the details. Mm-hmm. And then maybe that wasn't as much the case, you know, in the past. And luckily that was kind of part of our brand DNA from the beginning. And so it's worked out really well. So our flavors have done a great job of helping to tell our, you know, brand story and this kind of this idea of flavors of the South and the diversity around flavors of the South very effectively.
And then supporting local, which I think is
really important. Yeah, and supporting local is critical.
Do me a favor, Mati. Let's go Let's pick the Wildflower Honey Vodka, because we're talking to, you know, a lot of industry people here in this segment of the show. So it's a corn. Your mash bill is 100% corn, right? Can you just take us kind of briefly through that? Let's just pick that vodka, the distillation process. What do you do? How do you start? And then when you blend the honey in, how does that go and all that?
Yeah, so it's 100% corn mash bill. We're 6 times distilled. We use a column still. So post distillation is when we do all of our flavor work. And so in the case of the honey, we are getting the honey in basically drums from Savannah Bee Company, and then it is being blended in with the vodka, with the finished vodka. You know, over a period of it was about a week that, you know, the process takes. And honey, you know, honey can be a tricky thing to work with, right? Because there's a fine line between having a nice, light, refreshing drinking experience and then having something that tastes more like a cordial. And also, you know, you've got settling issues with honey, and there's a lot there that you have to kind of account for if you want to create something that is really shelf stable, as well as versatile. And if you notice, I mean, of all of our products, we generally, all of them are totally crystal clear, except for the Wildflower Honey, which just has a tinge of color to it. And that's because we're using real honey. And you know, there's really no way to make it totally clear. So, but yeah, it took a while. You know, when we were started in this project, we were trying a lot of different types of honey. We were trying Tupelo honey. We were, I can't recall now how many types of honey, you know, the team at Savannah Bee Company sent us, but it was quite a bit. And, you know, there was a question of, you know, what's going to be, you know, one, what is going to taste the best, but then two is what's going to allow us to have a consistent product. Because some of these, you know, the benefit of Wildflower honey is this kind of it's like a blend of sorts. And so what we found is, one, we could get enough of it, but then two, there was consistency, or there's more consistency across kind of the batches, whereas some of the more of specialized honeys, like a Tupelo honey, one, it's limited. It's more limited in terms of availability. But you know, there was definitely some, and Ted, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a little bit more variety in terms of the taste. And so, you know, our goal is when we put out a product, you know, if someone picks up the Wildflower honey tomorrow and then picks up a bottle in 3 months' time, we want them to have a similar, you know, experience.
That's
with that
critical. Product. Sure.
So that was a big part of, you know, the formulation process of how do we do that with something that was ultimately being, you know, harvested on a seasonal basis.
It's an agricultural, you know, product,
with
it, right?
With a lot of our products.
Yeah, it's an agricultural product, right? So I mean, you got to balance that game. Well, Ted, so was that kind of your inclination too, that this was going to be the way to go?
Well, you know, probably I can't remember but we probably would have sent Orange Blossom, which is, we can get a consistent supply. The taste is pretty similar year to year. It's not always the color's not always the same. You can get a little dark some years. Tupelo is, that's, I love it. It's my favorite honey. And then the acacia honey, I bet we would have sent super, it's sort of like the vodka. I mean, I'm hearing this, it's light in color, light in taste, just real, if there's any argument against it, it's that it doesn't have enough taste in there.
Is that, I'm sorry to interrupt, this just because it pops into my head. So when we say acacia, are you talking about, what is it? The black locust tree?
Yeah, right. Man, good on you for even knowing that.
Well, okay, so the reason why this is a tangent, but the reason why I even ask you that is because I know some winemakers that are friends of mine out in California, and I used to work in the wine industry out there, and they're using acacia wood for aging vessel, for barrels, but it's a different species.
So there's the acacia like in Africa, like you expect, those acacia trees.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but this is the black locust tree that we're talking about.
And black locust is like an eastern tree, more uplands, and that's all over New York City.
Right.
But it doesn't grow in dense stands. It has thorns on it, like the acacia tree. It's real twisted, hard bark. They made furniture out of it. The reason they call it that, the scientific name is Robinia pseudo-acacia. So it's like a false acacia. They sent it as an ornamental to like Italy and Hungary and Yugoslavia. and 400 years ago, mind you, that long ago, and it took over. So now I think maybe it's Yugoslavia, maybe 40% of their forest is acacia, like, or black locust. So you have these dense stands, so they make this beautiful, clear, light honey year after year. I mean, you could argue it's an invasive species, which is not good over there. But at this point, 400 years later, they're lobbying to protect it. It's interesting.
Do we have any mead coming out for you guys? Putting any black locust mead out?
We do have some. Yeah, we certainly do. But the Tupelo, like you were mentioning, Mati, this year there's almost none made. Like literally almost none made. Like you'd be hating it, right? And this is why it's a bad business to be in, the honey business. Like you realize why people used to, like, you know, sacrifice a lamb and roll around in the dirt to bring good fortune on this year's harvest or something, because you are absolutely up to the, it's all up to the weather, really. It's weather determined, and we had cold weather this spring, rain, tornadoes, all kinds of stuff. So almost no Tupelo honey was made.
So like Mati, in your case, and like the, so with wildflower, then the decision was made because maybe the mix of what's in the field blend, if you will, I'm using that wine term, might vary a little bit, but if it's predominantly holly, like you said, Ted, you're going to get a consistency year after year and on a more predictable level.
I know that I can supply that for him pretty much consistently. So
gotcha. Okay.
I mean, you can answer him with either.
And it also, I mean, in our taste test, it really worked well. It tasted great. But yeah, you know, like when you're creating products, you have to think about, you know, it's the taste is most important, but then you got to think about supply chain and, you know, how you can kind of consist, unless it's just meant to be, you know, a single release and then, you know, it's less of a concern. But, you know, our goal with the product is to have it be a core staple in our lineup and people love it. So we want to make sure it's not going anywhere.
Right. And this is, and I appreciate you saying that, because this is going to matter to not only the consumer, as you were saying before, but like, you know, vodka, hopefully, you know, is meant to be used on premise a lot, right? And cocktails, and bartenders are going to depend on a consistency if it's in their cocktail list.
100%. Yeah.
Let me ask you, Mati, one question, because we were talking about this during the break. I'd be remiss otherwise if I didn't, given what we talk about on the show frequently. We talked about this last week on the show. You're the official vodka of NASCAR. NASCAR has been in the news lately because they recently banned the use or bringing in or any sort of presentation of the Confederate flag at NASCAR events. And I just wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, so it's been a long time coming. You know, NASCAR has attempted to do that in the past. They had a flag exchange program before, where basically you're flying Confederate flag, they come nicely ask you to take an American flag instead. Given the current environment and Bubba Wallace coming out and making a stand, you know, it really provided, it was the perfect opportunity for NASCAR to come out and deal with something that really, and they agreed. I mean, it's something that they've been wanting to deal with for a while. And so as the official vodka of NASCAR and, you know, entitlement sponsor of the Dixie Vodka 400, you know, we came out, I came out with a statement after they made that decision in support of the decision. I think, you know, as a partner in NASCAR, the goal really is to how do we expand NASCAR to new fans, right? And to do so, you really need to create a very fan friendly, family friendly, inclusive environment. And I think everyone was on, you know, I mean, I agree. It was like, listen, the Confederate flag was not helping to do that, right? And so it was about time that happened. And you know, I also know, you know, as Dixie Vodka, you know, it's, we have a role to play in, you know, how we think about and define and what we highlight in the South today. I mean, Dixie's been the singular nickname for the region for 200 years. And my view on it has always been, and it's kind of articulated over, you know, this past couple weeks in particular with everything going on is, you know, Dixie has never really been about the South of the past. It's always been about the South of the present at any given time, right? So, you know, the South of 2020 is different from the South of 1920, and it's will be different from the South of 2120. Mm-hmm. And so we have a role in deciding what do we want. What do we want the South to represent today? And what do we want Dixie as the nickname for the South to represent today? And it's been great. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback from my statement in support of NASCAR's position. We've had a lot of engagement with, we worked with some, we actually had a great event that we did with Savannah Bee Company earlier this year in Charleston. It was actually a lot around mead as well, but with two great bartenders and influencers in Charleston called the Cocktail Bandits, and Johnny and Tanika, two African-American women who have been doing great things to try and bring about more diversity and inclusivity within the trade. Which is obviously really important. We were talking the other day about, okay, well, let's double down on these efforts and what can we do to really bring this about. And I think, you know, as Dixie Vodka, you know, are leading the charge on that, helping lead the charge on that is meaningful. Mm-hmm. And so we're, you know, it's something that I've, you know, I'm excited to be part of, and then as it relates to NASCAR, it's great. I mean, we had, as an example, and this will be, you know, relevant to you in New Orleans, but we had Alvin Kamara, the running back for the Saints, in our suite for the Dixie Vodka 400. And I had a great opportunity to sit down and chat with him for. I mean, there were a lot of delays in our race. It took a lot longer than it should have because of lightning delays. And so we had a great chance to catch up. And, you know, he was a perfect example. Before the Confederate flag announcement, you know, he wasn't a NASCAR fan. You know, even when he was at Alabama, he grew up in Atlanta. And so he would, going from Alabama to Atlanta, he would pass by Talladega. And, you know, he always noticed it, but he never really occurred to him to really kind of check it out. And now he's, you know, all of a sudden he's a NASCAR fan, and he loved his experience, and he's talking about going to Talladega this weekend, and, you know, it's the right thing to do. But it also, it just helps people feel more comfortable. And NASCAR is a great sport. It's a great family friendly sport. It's a great experience. And I think everyone's on the same page from a NASCAR and partner standpoint that we just want to facilitate that kind of environment, and we don't need things that detract from it.
You know, I thank you for saying that. I think I remember reading, I think it was a NASCAR official, if I recall correctly, said the other day that, you know, this isn't about excluding you. This is about welcoming everyone. And right. I think that actually was really well said, because I think that it is exactly what's relevant today. It's just because somebody's demanding what they should be getting in the first place doesn't mean that you don't get it too. It doesn't take away from you. So I thank you for saying that. You guys, we'll close out this portion of the show because I know we all have places to be. Ted, one more time, will you tell people where they can find? Did you want to add something? Or I'm looking at your face, but okay. Just tell us where we can find Savannah Bee Company and tell us about Bees for the Bee Cause again, please.
Yeah, so we are SavannahBee.com, SavannahBee.com, and you can get through to the Bee Cause through us, but as well, we have a website for the not-for-profit called the Bee Cause, the Bee Cause Project, but the website is thebeecause.org. So thebeecause.org, and B, of course, is B-E-E.
Cool. And we'll have links on our website. And Mati, one more time for Dixie Vodka.
Yeah, so it's as simple, dixievodka.com. Go in there, find out where we're distributed. Go into your local liquor store, ask for us, bar, restaurant, and if they don't have us, then ask them to get it. And hopefully, you know, as we expand out, more and more people can experience all our unique flavors of the South and you know, get a good cocktail.
Awesome. Keep us posted on the Puerto Rico project too. We'll talk again about that. Thanks so much, you guys. I really appreciate your time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
It's been so fun.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, you guys. Hey, we're going to take a brief break, musical interlude here. I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the program, friends. I always appreciate having you here on the NOLA Drinks Show. Quick programming note for you. I think I mentioned this at the top of the broadcast. No new show coming up here right away. We took the week off there from the 4th of July holiday, but we'll have a new show the week after. We're going to be featuring a wine region in California, Northern California, in the Bay Area, the Livermore Valley, a place very near and dear to my heart. Why? Because more or less that's where I'll say in large part cut my chops in the wine industry in that part of the world. So I look forward to sharing that special place with you. Be on the lookout for that. Friends, this is our parting shot, and I want to applaud NASCAR for what they've done. I think they've got a long road to go. Obviously, out of all the major and secondary major sports, they perhaps have the most to lose given who their fan base is. I think that goes without saying. Of course, we're already seeing a considerable amount of pushback and protest and stupidity and all that, and I think everybody knows that. You know, I would say that the ban on the Confederate flag at NASCAR events is a substantive move. That's doing the work. But we also have to note, of course, regardless of whether the investigation found that this noose was not targeting Bubba Wallace, that's a good thing. Somebody still put a noose in a garage in October of last year at the Talladega event. And the numbers were something such that out of the 1,600, I believe, plus garages across all the tracks, I think it's 29 tracks that NASCAR uses, 44 of those garage spaces are at Talladega. Across all of those garage spaces, they only found 11 rope poles and, of course, only one that was a noose. It's a big organization. Big organizations are going to have bad apples. But it's a fact of the matter. They've got a long way to go. Certainly seeing the drivers and the pit crews and all of that walk the racetrack flanking Bubba Wallace in his car was a powerful message. But it's going to take a lot more than the performative than just that. It's going to take things like them banning the Confederate flag and doing the work. And when the starts to hit the pocketbook, which I think is going to happen for NASCAR as they lose some of their fan base, they're going to have to stick to their guns. I hope they do. And again, I applaud them for what they did. Want to shift gears here a little bit, That's what I'm doing, shifting gears on you here a little bit. You know, we're seeing these spike in COVID-19 cases, and for regular listeners of the show, you know that I actually live across the lake from New Orleans in a town called Mandeville, which is in St. Tammany Parish. If you're not from the area, it's across Lake Pontchartrain, and a parish is essentially a county, and everybody's kind of making parish by parish level decisions in how they implement some of the restrictions as it relates to COVID-19. Now, the state level ones are, in most places, I think it's kind of the same. The state level ones are as they are. And then, you know, local municipalities and parishes and such here can make the decisions to be more stringent if they choose to. And now with the spike of cases that we're actually seeing, which has been substantial, seeing this around the country everywhere, and certainly here in Louisiana, we've seen local municipalities. New Orleans is, you know, you got to wear a mask when you go out. Jefferson Parish, which is adjacent to New Orleans, just to the west, and the city of Kenner, also in Jefferson Parish, made that decision. Our parish president, Mike Cooper, refused to make that decision. Now, if people were doing what they were supposed to be doing over here, I'd probably be a little bit okay with that. But compliance around here is not good. The number of people patronizing places, I typically just see them in the grocery store because that's about all I go to. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are not wearing masks. I've even been to a couple stores, markets, that the employees are no longer wearing masks. And they're, you know, dealing with food, butcher shop, that kind of thing. Compliance here, as I said, is not good. It's not right or it's not fair, especially to those of us who are doing what we're supposed to be doing, which is frankly not fun, as I think we know. It's not fair that we all of us are going to have to slip back into more stringent restrictions. That's going to further damage the economy, and it's going to harm, quote unquote, the way of life that so many of you non-mask wearers espouse to cherish. Do your part. It's ridiculous and telling to me of how many of elected officials have politicized a public health issue that threatens and affects all of us. Now, listen to everyone out there, especially you young people. This is not, quote, me first. This is we first, all of us. Certainly something, this is something that needs to permeate our entire society. We need to develop a true sense of community mindedness, not just putting yourself and your inconveniences first. Do we need a national response? Sure. Are we going to get one? Yeah, right. With that clown in office and our national elected officials, many of them anyway, not a chance. Do we need better policies and enforcement? Absolutely. But that's not really realistic. The resources aren't there on a local level to do the proper level of enforcement, at least in most areas, enforcing the behavior of individuals. Do businesses need to step up? Sure. But that's also really an unfair burden to put on businesses, isn't it? That they have to police their customers when they come in? Ultimately, friends, this is an individual choice to do what's right. This is what being a member of a community, is about. This is what this country is supposed to be about. There's really much more that can be said on this issue. But what I'm asking you to do is think of others. This is, again, not me first. This is we first. Don't be an ass. Wear a mask. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.
All these signs and all these sinners we've tried.